you, Mr. Cross, for introducing me in full-fledged glory, getting that middle name Horatio in there. There aren't many politicians that can claim that, and most of them are happy that they cannot. And to my esteemed friend and colleague of many years, John Riley, members of the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. Since I prepared these remarks that I shall give you this evening, many things have happened. And of course, today, just prior to your coming to this gathering tonight, most of you, I'm sure, have heard the news on radio or television that another attempt on the life of our president was made by a would-be assassin. As an American, I feel terribly upset about this, and as a fellow human being, I feel even more sad. Violence has plagued the American political scene, and nothing could be more destructive than the hopes and the aspirations of free people than the use of violence in any form. I hope and pray that those of us who are in public life will not be deterred in any way from our work and our responsibilities to be with the people because of the mad act or acts of a few who undoubtedly are the victims of some sort of torment of their own. People have asked me earlier this evening, what are you going to say about this, Senator? And I said, what is there to say? Except not only to deplore it, condemn it, but to hope and pray that these would-be agents of violence will realize the folly of their way and will be promptly apprehended and punished. But I think there's something more, greater depth to this than just the act. It is the feeling on the part of some that the processes of reason, persuasion, processes of convincing through argument, peaceful demonstration are not enough. Those who believe that they can take things into their own hands are destroyers. They are never saviors. And I have no easy remedy for these conditions or for these actions. I've always felt there are far too many guns in the hands of people who didn't know how to use them. Maybe a few more instances like this will bring the reality of this critical condition to our attention, to a point where we'll do something about it. Let's hope and pray that it never happens again. Thank goodness the president was not injured. The Secret Service takes every precaution, I can assure you, to protect the life and the safety of the President of the United States and his family, and even vice presidents. And they're a very fine professional group. But every one of us that's in public life knows, particularly when you occupy the high offices, that there's no real protection except, on the one hand, good fortune, and on the other hand, faith and trust in people. So tonight, if you just quietly say to yourself, thank God, in all reverence, that this act of someone undoubtedly tormented the man was not successful. I know the president is going to be deterred anyway. He's a tough guy. He has lots of strength and lots of courage. I have my disagreements with him, but it's not on this issue. I'm sure he knows that our good wishes go to him from here tonight. Let's send it to him the best way that we know how to do our response. As I see it, this is such a wide open subject that it is impossible to know where to begin. begin, and I'm afraid that I may have some difficulty going for a stop. But Chicago is a good place to discuss the future of America's foreign policy, and indeed it's a good place to discuss the future of America. I like this city. I like the spirit of America. I like this spur, the sense of confidence that is here. It's very much a part of the American Republic in its finest tradition. This great city of America's heartland is an international city, even if some people on the Eastern Seaboard don't know. It's a city of finance and of world trade. It's a city of international research and learning. And it is an international center of art, literature, music, creative thought. And the people of this city, and indeed this city itself, looks beyond our national borders for economic and intellectual sustenance. Because of this basic fact of the life of this city, I take this opportunity here at your invitation to share my thoughts about America's role in what we constantly call a changing world. It's always changing. The question is, do we understand the changes that are taking place? Now, one of the most fundamental, as I see it, and far-reaching changes in American foreign policy began at the end of the last decade, and it is still occurring today. I speak of the growing importance of economic policy as the central focus of national security and foreign policy. It has now even begun to overshadow some of our more traditional strategic and military concerns. It is not a substitute, but it has a direct bearing. Policymakers must still be concerned with security matters as they relate to maintaining vital alliances, dealing with other superpowers, and mediating regional conflicts. But as I see it, the basic thrust of America's foreign policy is now shifting. And the question is, does the government understand it? And will we, the people, who ultimately make up the government, today, greater economic security for all nations is vital to world peace. Pope Paul said in one of his encyclicals that peace is the new name, or development is the new name for peace. We seem to forget that. And I happen to believe that economic security is maybe as vital as the end of the nuclear arms race. And that such security can only be achieved with policies which recognize the imperatives of global interdependence. It's a good time to talk about that because so many people now feel that all we ought to do is just take care of ourselves. I don't disagree with that. The question is, how do you take care of yourself? Not whether you take care of yourself. We have a right to be concerned about our nation, our country, our community, our family, ourselves, individually. The question is, what is the better way? Now, the battles that are going on in the world against recession and unemployment and inflation have become as important to nations as the maintenance of their defense capabilities, and in some areas, even more important. The management or the availability of global resources, the free and assured flow of these products, and the eradication of hunger and disease have become and must become central issues of foreign policy. The American people, I believe, are beginning to understand this, and they are beginning to know what it means for their lives. I know that many of this community's distinguished citizens are in the forefront of this sort of understanding. In the past, it's been mighty easy for us to go our own way. We had two oceans that protected us. We didn't look upon them as a bridge, we looked upon them as a barrier. We're sitting all by ourselves in a very real sense. We've been blessed with a huge domestic market and abundance of natural resources. Sometimes I think we fail to understand how richly endowed we are. And that isn't because we've had a great government or a great corporation or a great trade is just by an act of nature of divine providence. We're the world's breadbasket. And it isn't only because of the productivity of our family farms, which is amazing, because of climate, because of soil. And those are things that neither the Democrats or the Republicans were able to do much about. We have been spared the destructive ravages and the physical damages of war for generations. Every time I go to Europe, I wonder, how did they rebuild that continent twice in my lifetime? From total devastation, practically. And yet they've done it, and we've never been called upon to do that. Oh, we say, well, we helped them. The amount of help that we gave, while important and timely, was minuscule. They've done it themselves in a very real way. We presently have been traumatized by the tragedy of Vietnam, the crisis of Watergate, the serious domestic economic problems that afflict us today of inflation and recession at the same time. First time that's ever happened in our history, by the way. And I wonder if we realize that. Many other times in our lives we've had recession, but it generally brought deflation. We had inflation, but it always brought and recession, one at the same time. Mm-hmm. And because of this, we begin to re-examine who we are, where we are, what we're doing. And we have begun to recognize the basic fact, slowly to be sure, but begin to recognize it of our independence. So I say a new internationalism has begun to mold the worldview of the American people. Just beginning, but it is here. And experts in public opinion confirm this. The new internationalism of the mid-1970s, and that's where we are, was not anything at all like the internationalism that you and I experienced in the late 40s, 50s, and 60s, the Cold War era. That outlook was founded on anti-communism, fear of world war, the dominance of traditional security considerations. But this new internationalism, which is just here in its embryonic form, rests on two other grounds. First, the United States no longer possesses the power to remain immune from economic fluctuations or economic developments around the world. We are no longer an island. We are a part of the main. The oceans no longer are a barrier. They are a conduit. We're tied into a great system. Energy crisis and the devaluation of the dollar are sharp reminders of this fact. We're beginning to understand that our domestic problems cannot be resolved without acting in concert with others. And I repeat the emphasis, beginning, because as yet it is not fully accepted. Secondly, the new internationalism rests on a recognition of a basic humanitarian obligation to others in the common struggle against economic and social injustice. That we've had before. It lost some of its impetus. I think it's beginning to return. But American foreign policy, our official policy, has been all too slow to reflect these important changes in the way that nations and peoples perceive their interests. It's my judgment that the imperatives of interdependence demand more than rhetoric or casual part-time emphasis. They demand the creation in this country of an economic policy which actually integrates domestic and foreign economic policy into a coherent whole. The old distinction between what was at home and what was abroad is, for the birds, so to speak, out of date. And the idea that you can keep these issues separate is to deceive both yourself and try to deceive others. No event or decision of any significance can occur on the domestic side of the American economy without international implications. When we catch cold, the world gets pneumonia. We still have to understand that. That doesn't make us omnipotent. It doesn't mean that we must tell the world what to do or where to go. It simply means that we must recognize our relationship to the total world economy. and significant economic events abroad, I'm sure you know, have an immediate impact here in America. Oil, coffee, trade, tariffs, all of these things come to play with us. Yet, dear friends, the executive branch of government and your Congress are shamefully fragmented and can't even begin to cope with the need for an integrated foreign and domestic economic policy. Now, you're going to immediately say, well, now there he is. Why doesn't he do something about it? Because I'm 1,535. Because, like most every other thing, we're locked into tradition and practice and institutions and forms. And in America, dear friends, we generally don't do what we need to do until we have to do it. We are a people that move on the basis of crisis. In 1975, we're organizing our decision-making as if the date was 1955. If I were to ask you what fundamental changes have taken between these 20 years, you could not tell me, nor could I tell you. We forget the disaster of the soybean embargo just a couple of years ago, where we tried to prevent inflation at home by damage to our relations with a major Pacific trading partner and customer at all. We said to the Japanese, you can't have any more soybeans, and so they went down to Brazil and bought 1 million acres of land, and another 500,000 this year, and said, fine, goodbye, Illinois. Goodbye, Minnesota, Iowa, Indiana. Goodbye, Arkansas. If you don't want to prepare, give us soybeans, we're going to buy them, we'll go produce it someplace else. In the meantime, we sent through the entire international community shockwaves of unpredictability. The one thing we cannot afford as a country that says it believes in markets, economics, is unpredictability. We forget that the global inflationary boom, and we've had one globally, was fueled in part by our inattention to economic events in Europe and Japan. In fact, we helped finance out of our large banks much of the inflationary boom which today haunts us and perils the world economy. We forget the disastrous effects of the first Russian grain deal, when all we thought about was our foreign policy needs, which were put above our domestic economic considerations. There was no weighing off. There was no real consultation. The fact was, it was good to sell the Russians, and we had some surplus, get rid of it, don't worry about tomorrow. And that grain deal not only affected our relationships with the Soviet Union, but it affected prices here at home, and it triggered prices, increases in food all over the world, because it liquidated the one residual reserve of food that was left in the world, which was the United States of America. It precipitated the most wild commodity speculation that the world has known in 100 years. But we weren't worried about that. We didn't have any mechanism to worry about it. The idea was sell it. And we did. We failed to comprehend the growing world food shortage and its impact at home and abroad. We've been living in a world of wishful thinking, haven't we? About energy. And in particular, oil. Despite repeated warnings of trouble ahead, what made you think for a minute, or what should have made me think for a minute, that the people in the OPEC countries were going to sell us oil at scandalously low prices forever? But that's what we've predicated our whole economic development upon. And then one day they gave us scandalously high prices, and it looks like forever. These and other developments reveal growing interdependence in a sort of a negative way. They point as well to the critical need for us to develop some mechanism for the design of international economic policy that protects our interests and at the same time takes into consideration the needs of others. Now, let me just divert a moment here to call your attention to something that's in the news every day. It's our relationships with the Soviet Union and trade. Because that's what makes the news. And when I look at it, I wonder if we even haven't lost our perspective. During the first 6 months of this year, U.S. exports to the Soviet Union amounted to approximately $520 million. But that's the news. I suppose it's because the bad boy in the park is quit kicking his mother in the leg and no longer is beating on his sister, which means that there's some good news. Now this figure of about a half a billion dollars is truly insignificant when we look at our trade over the past 6 months, or the same 6 months of 1975, with some of our other regular customers. Japan, $4.9 billion. We take that for granted. We spend more time talking to the Russians about a little trade in 1 year than we spend with the Japanese in a decade. West Germany, $2.6 billion. Brazil, $1.4 billion. 3 times as much. And a market that's barely capped, right at our back door. England, we're constantly reading about the British going broke. Nevertheless, they paid for $2.4 billion of American exports in the last 6 months. Now, this doesn't mean that I'm uninterested in Soviet trade, because any new customer is a valuable customer. We even feel that way in Humphrey's drugstore. But we don't quite forget our regular customers. It's interesting to note that we exported more to India or to Switzerland during this same period than we did to the Soviet Union. And I don't believe I've read a thing in the Chicago papers or the Minneapolis papers about our exports to Switzerland. But a Russian wheat deal and the possibility of another has forced us to begin to seriously take a look at international economic policy, and maybe that's why it's worthwhile. But I submit that our policies with most of our regular customers, our industrialized partners, are relatively reactive. We react rather than to affirm or stake out. I don't think that we can wait for another crisis to provide an excuse for action. We need to develop our policy with our traditional trading partners in the industrialized nations, but at the same time, place much greater emphasis than in the past upon our relationships with what we call the developing countries. Why? Well, it's humanitarian, to be sure, but that doesn't motivate you enough, because it's necessary. It is these areas where the rich and abundant raw materials are to be found and developed. So I must say, in the most simple and direct and maybe unromantic terms, it's the question whether you like Africa or South America or certain parts of Asia. The fact of the matter is that if we're going to be a major economic force in the world, if we're going to have a high standard of living, if we're going to realize any of the goals and objectives that we've set out for our individual families, we're going to have to get along with these people, and we're going to have good working relationships with them, and we're going to have to quit taking them for granted. They're going to have to be consulted. They're going to have to be dealt with. We're going to have to endure their insults. And they're going to have to get accustomed sometimes to our miscalculations. But together, we must work it out. We need them. And I'll tell you something, there's nothing like being needed. And they know now that they need us. The United States, Europe, Japan, the developing countries, all of us are going through exactly the same experiences at this time. Suffering from recession, inflation, and high unemployment. All of us are having difficulty combating these problems with the traditional economic practices. There isn't anybody that I have found that quite knows how to do it. You can always find someone that knows, as I said earlier, how to combat recession. He's written 14 books on it. Then you'll find a good, solid, conservative banker that knows how to fight inflation, tighten up the money, raise the interest rates. That'll do it. But when you get both high blood pressure and a serious infection at the same time, it's mighty difficult to find the right person. Particularly if there's no doctor around that's ever had to treat such a patient. that's where we are. Now let's take a look then at how we might develop a process of economic interdependence. Let's take a look at how it works. I want to bring you back now just a few years, right? No ancient history, contemporary, 1971, 72, 73. Those were good years. You take a look at the charts. Good years for every major developed country. Economic policymakers have been pursuing policies of all-out growth without bothering to add up the cumulative effect of their decision. The result? These countries were confronted with rising rates of inflation. Inflation reached 17% in France in 1973, a relatively high 8% in Germany and 10% in Japan. What was the solution to the problem? Well, the old economic religion, tighten up the money, hike up the interest rates. And that's what they did, and that's what we did, that's what each nation did unilaterally. We did it without consulting one another, and we ended up with everybody having the disease twice as bad as when we started. We either had the arrogance or the ignorance to disregard the impact of these decisions on one another. Every decision affected and reinforced the other. Monetary growth, now this is technical stuff, but monetary growth in America fell to 6% in 1973 from 9% the previous year. In France, it went from 19% down to 9%. In Germany, it went from 16% down to 1%. Taken individually, these policies meant a slowdown in economic growth. Taken collectively, they meant a major world recession of tremendous proportions, the worst since the Great Depression. A recession to which this country of ours is barely recovering. And slowly at that, and with which Europe and Japan are still struggling, and the worst yet to come. A recession which could easily strike the American economy once again. Many people believe, of course, that this recession was due to the Arabs or to the farmers. They're easy to pick up. Either through the oil or through the food. Simplify it. You can get it in one paragraph. Two-paragraph headline tells it all. But the trouble with economics, it doesn't lend itself to simplification. The fact is that in all of Western Europe, the United States, and Japan, industrial production was beginning to decline for anybody that wasn't blind as a bat by 1973. In England, the decline started in the second quarter of 1973. And in the United States, there were warning signs in the second quarter of 1973. We've been in a recession 16 months before anybody in government acknowledged it was here. It's like having somebody moving into your house, occupying the room, and being in the bathroom when you want to get in, and you say, what's gone wrong? The door seems locked. And nobody investigated just to see whether somebody was there. The worldwide recession was well underway before the October war in the Middle East. But we were still going along saying it's great. Everything's fine. It was the unilateral pursuit of these restrictive monetary policies to combat inflation in the industrialized countries which precipitated the beginning of the recession. What the energy crisis did, the oil embargo, was merely to accentuate it, to overwhelm governmental efforts to roll back inflation. And added to that was the world food crisis. It forced prices everywhere up. It forced us deeper into a recession. It created the worst of all possible economic worlds, and it forced us to question the effectiveness of traditional economic policies. And when those energy and those food bills roared up to the ceiling, they only made matters worse by increasing the depth and the duration of the recession. Now don't misunderstand me, oil and food had an important impact. My point is that before there was oil and food high prices, there was a beginning of an international economic recession and inflation that was really the product of individual efforts made around the world, first for rapid growth and then secondly for restrictive policies without regard to what was happening to anybody else. In other words, the energy crisis has disguised the harm of uncoordinated deflationary policies in industrialized countries. To put it simply, if you can blame somebody else for it, it's much easier that way. The magnitude of the political and economic decisions necessary for coordination of economic policy is immense. And it's not going to come easily, nor is it going to be in short term. The real truth is that it requires the attention not only of the experts, but of the heads of government, and heads of government are not experts. You have to remember that heads of government are political figures. I said to a luncheon group today that experts should be on top, not on top. Policy decisions have to be made by people who are elected or however they get into power. The experts are there to either reinforce or to advise or counsel. I use the traditional example today of the common market, the European common market. All of the technicians and experts said it was impossible. But the political leaders, the Schumanns and the others, France and Belgium and Germany, they got together at Rome and said it will be done. And the Rome Treaty was not the result of lawyers and economists. It was the result of politicians who made the decision and then called in the experts and says, we've made the decision, now you boys put it together. And that's what's got to be done. Therefore, I propose, in light of what I've tried to demonstrate here, faultingly, I realize, the interdependence and the interrelationship of these individual actions that take place, that we get to where we ought to be. We've had summits on whether or not we ought to have arms control. We've had summits with the Russians, summits with the Chinese. We've had summits in Helsinki. I propose an economic summit to be convened to bring together the heads of government of industrialized nations of Europe, America, Japan, to discuss the specific coordination of their domestic economic policies so that we're working on the same track, that we're at least within a framework of guidelines. It's essential that they discuss and arrive at acceptable policies in the field of energy, food, employment, trade and credits, and with specific purpose of developing a strategy for rapid recovery. That economic summit can focus attention on other questions of the industrialized nations. It's not a substitute, however, for matters presently under discussion like trade and monetary policy. But it would highlight these discussions. And it ought not to be looked upon as a confrontation with OPEC or developing countries. Because the real truth is that if the industrialized nations can pull together, it gives the best opportunity for them to work out a common policy with what we call third world countries. And one of the key issues of a summit would be how to integrate the developed countries' aid and other policies to the benefit of the third world. And it's my judgment that such an economic summit would benefit all trading nations, a recovery which would benefit the industrialized and the developed countries. But let me issue a warning here tonight. Recovery in America, Europe, and Japan could be slowed or even reversed in a very short order within the next month by any selfish or short-sighted action on the part of oil-producing nations. I hope and pray that it won't happen. Rumors abound that the OPEC countries, that's the oil-producing, exporting countries, will again increase the price of oil. The question is how much? If it's 10 to 15%, you could have reverberations which would have unbelievable negative impact. If it's modest, 5% or less, it will have less of an impact, obviously. But if there's another OPEC price increase and it's added to the unwise step urged by the president to decontrol domestic oil and add the $2 tariff and keep it, changes or chances for rapid economic recovery, I submit to this audience, will be seriously damaged or aborted. The recovery in this nation is fragile, slow, and sluggish. Anything that disrupts it would set us back to a point where we'd have to start all over again. And I can assure you that that would be felt in every country in the world. Therefore, we need to remind our OPEC neighbors that large oil price increases can only have a destructive effect on the foreign economies in which they have invested so heavily, and on third world economies already shaken by high energy bills. But America's economic interdependence reaches beyond the range, as I've said, of the problems shared with the industrialized world. Those third world countries, their poverty diminishes the hope of world peace and economic security. When are we going to understand that? The great waste of human resources magnifies the loss in global productive capacity. Food that's not grown, factories that are not built, minerals that are not developed or extracted, and markets not developed. It is therefore a political, economic, and moral imperative that we and others address the growing disparity between the rich and the poor nations. This hasn't got anything to do about whether you think you're a good Samaritan. You don't have to be a missionary to get involved in this. This is a matter of survival. I therefore was encouraged by the recent special session of the UN, when our country, thank goodness, took a lead, got away from the foot dragging, began to move into the forefront, into a role of leadership. In fact, I believe this special UN session marked an extraordinary breakthrough in the relations between the developing and the industrialized world. And may I add quickly that here again, the Congress had its input. Some of us in this past year have been meeting regularly with the officials in the executive department to encourage a new and a more positive approach in the United Nations in terms of the economic policies that we would pursue with the third world countries and our partners of the industrial world. And the United States came out of that seventh special session looking good. Came out, may I say, with new friends. Came out with an entirely new image. And why? Because we began to recognize in ourselves that we had a role to play, were able to convey that to others, not as one that wanted to dominate their lives, but one that wanted to coordinate our activities with theirs. Now, to be practical and pragmatic for a moment, the cornerstone of any attack, however, upon this global disparity between the rich and the poor, and upon global poverty, is increased food production. And here's where we excel. We've got to act in concert with others. But increased food production requires increased investment in agriculture. I don't suppose I need to tell a Midwest audience that agriculture is a highly capitalized industry. The day of saying, well, if you can't do anything else, farm is all over. The fact is, if you can't farm, then you can do anything else. In other words, farming takes an expertise. It's maybe the most complex of all of our economic activity. But most of the capital that will be needed for this advance in agricultural production must come from the developing countries themselves. But here again, we can help. The World Bank, bilateral aid, and the proposed new International Agricultural Development Fund. I've joined 25 other senators and congressmen of both political parties in proposing that we take some of the repayment of former aid loans that we've loaned, monies that we've loaned to other countries, as they repay it, that we recycle that money and put it into an international agricultural development fund. And it will be vitally important to us. The development of a more self-sufficient food policy for the third world should be accompanied by a world food policy in which the United States can and should play a major role. Ladies and gentlemen, the largest agricultural reserve country in the world has not played a leading role. Because we are still committed to what we call market policies in a world in which there aren't that many free markets. The components of this national food policy for America and the international food policy that I envision is as follows. First, the creation of an international food reserve maintained by as many countries as possible, both developed and developing. And secondly, a full and free exchange of food production and marketing information. These are the essentials The United States does not have, as of this night, a national food policy. We have a policy of production and a policy of selling. But that's not enough. We do not have a national food reserve policy. As a matter of fact, that's what the argument is all about, even between Mr. Meade and Mr. Butts and Mr. Ford, once they get rid of the shipping question as to whether or not American U.S. ships will be used. What is it that this audience would like to see in the main in food? As we see the demand upon America's resources for food, as consumers see that demand raising food prices, the answer is a national food reserve that will take care of the domestic needs of this country in good times and bad. If every person in Chicago could be assured that there was enough wheat, corn, soybeans, that there was enough of anywhere of the cereals and the proteins to give stability to price on the one hand and assurance of supply on the other, you would not be worried about exports. The American farmer needs exports just exactly as the American automobile producer needs sales of his cars. Our agricultural economy depends in a large measure on exports. And what is more important, without American food exports, this country would be in literally international economic bankruptcy. Because it's farmers, and because it's individuals and not huge corporations, we miscalculate. Oh, how we like to read that IBM exported so many computers. Or that RCA or somebody else did it. Some big company that has a name brand that's on television. Ladies and gentlemen, those exports fade into insignificance. They're like a peanut stand at a baseball game as compared to the ownership of an NFL franchise when it comes to agriculture. Agriculture is the earner, the moneymaker. Agriculture, planes, and high technology. That's what we have to export in large measure. Last year, we exported a net in agricultural commodities in net of over $12 billion, which was exactly what we needed to buy the oil so we can live as we like to live. And the day that we can't export, it's a day that you better put the old car in the garage, get the kerosene lamp out, batten down the hatches, and get ready to return to the 1800s. Because it's that old family friend of yours out there on the South 40, in southern Illinois and southern Minnesota and eastern Iowa that's keeping you going. This country is not going because it exports steel. We import it. This country is not making money because we export textiles, we import it. This country is solvent today internationally and has a trade balance because you've got 5 million family farm producers out there that are doing their job. And they want to have a chance to make a living like anybody else. And all that they want is a chance to sell their product in the world market. And all that you and I need is an assurance that when we sell, that we don't sell at all so that we run out. You'd think that somebody that had an eighth grade education would be able to work that out. What would you think of Arthur Burns tomorrow morning as chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank if he said, we don't want the banks to have any reserves from here on out. We want them to loan it all out. Just loan it all. Just loan it. They'd impeach him and put him in jail, or they'd put him in some kind of a mental institution, one of the three. And all of them he deserved. He didn't. What would you think tomorrow morning if Secretary Schlesinger of the Department of Defense announced that we're going to abandon all of our reserves? We don't need any of this stuff. We're just going to live on cash and carry. If we need something, we'll call up Remington and Winchester and Sears Walmart. You'd say, get rid of that. But we've got an agricultural policy in this country that says, well, we're going to depend on good luck. We'll just sell anything we can sell. And if we have any left over, goody, goody, goody. And if we don't do that, it was the market. Which puts the farmer in an impossible situation, and it's only made for one little limited group, and that's speculators who don't know the difference between a corn cob and a ukulele. I submit to this audience that if we can have strategic reserves of tin, if we can have strategic reserves of manganese, if we can have strategic reserves of rubber, copper, of all the many efforts that this country says it needs for its security and pay the bill for that reserve, we can have a strategic reserve of food, separate and insulated and isolated from the normal commercial market. So that we have some of that. Now, having said that about our own country, other countries need to do this. Because we need to put up the warning flag. Not because we're angry or because we want to be mean, because